But the point is that I know how to handle these crises.
We are and always will be the United States of America.
Excuse me, Fox News.
A series of tubes.
I think you look pretty good.
I'll get Osama bin Laden, my friends. I'll get him. I know how to get him.
E pluribus unum. Out of many, one.
If some of those jobs are lost in this, so be it.
Thank you, Wisconsin!
Liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, moderates of all opinions, welcome to Civil Discourse. My name is Eric Brandt, and with me, as always, is former state senator of Wisconsin, Peter Baer. How's it going, Peter?
I'm going fine, Eric. How are you? Well, it's going fine for me. Unfortunately, it's not going fine for Republicans other than those on the extreme right, based on the news that we've had this week.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We're expecting a call from Omar Kalika, who is running in the Democratic primary for Wisconsin's first congressional district. He has not called in yet, so we're kind of waiting on that. But in the second half of the show, Mike McCabe from Wisconsin Democracy Campaign will be calling in to talk about what is going on, the recent scandal from the video of Mike Ellis, who was caught having a couple of drinks and talking about starting a super PAC, which is illegal for candidates to do for themselves.
Right. You know, I think, Eric, come on. You mentioned after a couple of drinks, and I think that is worth mentioning because that was the environment in which this sort of undercover video was done. The people who did it knew what they were doing. You know, the pattern of quite a few state legislators, Senator Ellis not being an exception, is to go over to one of several watering holes close to the Capitol in the evening and just kind of hang out, have a few drinks. And this one inn on the park is certainly one of those haunts where legislators hang out. And these folks knew that if they could just get talking to him in there, and he had probably with the benefit of some alcohol, a looser tongue, that who knows what might come out of his mouth. And it sure was interesting.
It was very interesting. So I'm looking forward to talking to Mr. McCabe about that, because he's certainly going to have some insight. He was actually the first person that I saw who had broken the story on Facebook. I had seen him. He was one of the first people to put up the video. In the meantime, in other news, the Senate, the U.S. Senate, has passed an extension of unemployment insurance retroactively, and it was a 59-38 vote.
Sounds like a couple of abstentions or absences. Someone had to go to the bathroom quickly, perhaps.
There was, I believe that Angus King, who normally caucuses with the Democrats, decided to vote against this, but I believe five Republicans did vote for it. And it was able to pass, and now it's going to the House of Representatives, where John Boehner refuses to bring it up for a vote.
Which five Republicans?
If you give me a second, I can find it for you.
The reason I asked that question, Eric, is because I'm curious as to whether the five Republicans who bucked party lines, as it were, to vote for the retroactive and ongoing unemployment extension are Republicans who are on the ballot this November in states that aren't necessarily solid red.
I've got some of the names here. Rob Portman of Ohio, Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, and Mark Kirk of Illinois.
Well, Illinois, blue state. Mm-hmm. Ohio, light shade of blue these days, we could say. Very light blue or purple. New Hampshire,
about the same.
Light blue, mm-hmm. or purple. So, yes. So, in other words, so the senators who are in states that are not solidly red, I'll bet you every single Republican senator from a solid red state voted against it.
Yeah. And, you know, we're going to talk a little bit more later on with Mike McCabe about the whole Mike Ellis thing and how they're kind of purging their party.
Ethnic cleansing.
Absolutely.
Except it's not based on ethnicity. It's based on ideology. Even if you're a conservative Republican with a 90%+ party line voting record, that's not good enough anymore. And if you don't believe me, ask Congressman Petri or any number of others, or former U.S. Senator Lugar.
absolutely. That's the one I was thinking of, Luger. But when, you know, they're talking about some of these moderates, and we're going to get into, you know, Petri and Ellis later. But when you think about it, you know, they also talk about Olympia Snow and Suzanne Collins of Maine being moderates. But I'll be honest with you, for the first, well, for Obama's entire first term and now, Olympia Snow is gone, but Suzanne Collins is still there. They could have broken these pointless filibusters. They could have crossed the line to help the economy. But they didn't do it. So even the moderates are not that moderate.
That's correct. But I agree with you completely on that, Eric. The voting records speak for that and to that. But so you want to ask oneself, what does it mean to be a moderate Republican? And if there really is such a thing, that's moderate Republicans. There used to be such a thing, that's for sure. People like Lincoln Chafee, who's, I think, now become a Democrat, if I'm not mistaken, in Rhode Island, but he was a Republican for years, as was his father, the progressive Republicans. My high school years were in New York. We had Nelson Rockefeller as governor back then, and he was certainly considered a moderate Republican. But now you get almost no votes, even out of those moderate Republicans, so harsh is the whip that is used over there in the halls of Congress. But the two from Maine that you just mentioned, the two senators from Maine, Snow and Collins, both voted no in the Senate on the conviction of President Clinton after he was impeached by the House, as did Arlen Specter, also gone now.
He had kind of signed his own death warrant when he switched to the Democratic Party.
That's true.
But his reason was purely political.
But almost everything that goes on is, and when he was still a Republican before he probably even had the notion of turning Democrat, he voted no on the conviction of William Jefferson Clinton, which meant that Clinton could finish his presidency. It's just the way it was. Not many Republicans did that. There was only five, as I recall.
So, like I said, the unemployment extension has been passed, and it's retroactive, so it will go back to help the people who lost their insurance on December 28th, and it's now sitting on John Boehner's desk, and of course, he is a Republican with a very strong Tea Party caucus who is threatening to force him out even before his term as Speaker is up now. And he is punting this, as the HuffPost put it, he is punting this back to the White House and saying that they already told Obama that this is unworkable. They want jobs extensions. They want jobs included in this bill, such as the Keystone XL pipeline. And most importantly, they want something to show that this is paid for. Well, the Republicans in the Senate who voted for this made sure that it was paid for, and that it wasn't going to increase the deficit. So that kind of takes that away. But what's really interesting, and I haven't heard anybody else point this out, is that John Boehner is telling the White House that they're not going to pass this unless it's paid for, it's offset somewhere. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, said that by simply passing the unemployment extension, that puts money in the hands of low-income people who are going to spend that money, which will drive the economy, creating more tax revenue, which will pay for it. Boehner is completely ignoring that. However, Paul Ryan, in his Path to Prosperity, for those who are already prosperous, has put the exact same logic when he said that we need to give tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires, and it will, quote, be paid for by the economic boom that will inevitably show up after we pass these tax cuts.
Regurgitating the trickle-down theory that has been proven without merit again and again.
That's exactly right. And nobody, I don't hear anyone in the media calling them out on this at all. I haven't even heard it mentioned.
Which is really shocking. It's depressing in terms of media diligence, and we need more of that.
I agree. So, like I said, I also read an article this week that there's about 40 or 50 Tea Partiers in the House who have had it with Boehner, and they are threatening to oust him as soon as the 2014 election is over. And they can't decide if they want to stick with the leadership in the House, which is John Boehner, Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, that crowd, or if they want to push something completely different and try to install new leadership, probably from the Tea Party caucus. They say that
those two words seem like oxymoronic.
Agreed. So even with these 40 or 50 people, and this just goes to show how deep the divide in the Republican Party is right now, even these 40 or 50 Republican, Tea Party Republicans, can't decide if they're going to they want to oust Boehner, but are they going to go with Eric Cantor, or are they going to go with somebody else?
Someone to the right, like, of Eric Cantor, what little space there is between the end of the universe and where they are as far as being right wing.
Exactly.
Someone has to be to the right of Cantor. He's pretty right already. Whether he actually is in his heart, who knows? But certainly the policies that he espouses. And I have to say that, you know, Cantor always looks to me, it's almost like a Shakespearean thing, out of a play like Macbeth or something. He looks like the guy lurking right behind Boehner, deciding whether to put literally a knife in his back or support him. From minute to minute.
That's exactly it. Tom Hartman talks about that all the time.
Really?
And he uses the exact same metaphor.
Does he?
And he says that Cantor is always standing behind Boehner with that shiv just tickling his kidney every time that he needs to make a decision.
And I see it the same way he does.
I think that's exactly what's happening, which is, I don't know. Boehner is not moderate. Boehner is conservative. I mean, I don't... Again, this goes back to what we were just talking about, that even moderate Republicans won't cross the line anymore because they're going to get pushed out and they're going to purge the party.
You know, I've just had an idea, Eric, seriously, that something that just occurred to me as we're talking here, and I'm reflecting on Congressman Petri, who I know personally, have known for over 40 years, thinking about Mike Ellis, who I also have known but served with, and other people who are pretty conservative Republicans. And we talked before about Lugar, for example. Lugar did some creative things in terms of foreign policy, even going with Obama when Obama was a U.S. senator for the short years that he was, went over to Europe to talk about containment of what nuclear weapons remained on the continent and so on. And so Lugar did some bipartisan type stuff like that, but his voting record was still very strongly Republican, as is Petri's, as is Ellis's, and all these other Republicans who are being driven out now, most of them at least, have very conservative voting records. But here's the common thread that I just thought about that runs through the people I just mentioned. For example, you know, Olympia Snow, Susan Collins, Mike Ellis, Tom Petri, Dick Lugar. What they have in common, besides conservative voting records, is that they aren't haters. They don't hate you just because you disagree with them. What you get from the Tea Party part of the Republican Party, which is really seems to be driving the train right now, is an actual animosity. They just don't like Republicans, it comes to me now, it's not enough to just vote against the Democrats. You must have animus towards them. There must be animus. And I know that word hatred is rather strong, and some people actually, it maybe goes that far. Some people, it maybe doesn't. But still, the word animus, I think, is a very good one to use. These people, the common thread among all the Republicans who seem to be getting put out of office by Tea Partiers, if you look at their voting records, it's not that they're not conservative, but they lack animus. These are people who are willing to work with folks who don't agree with them to try and reach some solutions that might be beneficial to society.
I would agree with that to a point, but an exception to what you just brought up, I would say, is Mike Ellis. Now, we know that Mike Ellis is portrayed as more moderate. He was against Act 10 originally, and we're going to, again, I don't want to get too far into this, but then you look at how he runs the Senate, and we've seen the video of the sit down, you're out of order, you know, and he's just screaming at all of his colleagues. That seems like animosity.
That was an ugly scene. But, I would like, just based on my knowing Senator Ellis, and I haven't had communication with him in recent years, but I did serve with him, and I have a sense of the man. And I think that was more of an exceptional moment. He tends not to be histrionic, hysterical like that. That was a horrible spectacle. But I would almost liken that to someone who's basically not a criminal person, but had a an incident that, where they had a domestic incident of some kind where they perhaps lashed out at somebody. And so and now they got that on their record, too. He really isn't the Mike Ellis who generally inhabits the Capitol isn't necessarily the Mike Ellis that was on display that day. He couldn't take the pressure of what was happening, and that's how he reacted, which was pretty pathetic. But he tends not to be a person with animus. I found it when I served with him, he was very open to talking back and forth. That's talking back and forth is not acceptable in the Republican Party anymore.
You know, everything that we're talking about, and this goes back arguably to at least 2008, after Obama got in, and then the Republic, or after Obama was elected and then inaugurated in 2009, and we've just seen this, you know, just hard right stance against everything that he does. And then in 2010, we saw this insurgency of the Tea Party hard right wingers who came into Congress, took over governorships, took over state houses. And then in 2012, you had the Rick Perrys, the Herman Cains, the Michelle Bachmans, who were extreme right wingers. And everyone was saying that Mitt Romney was too moderate. But he held it about 25% throughout that entire primary. And they tried everybody. They tried everybody. Everybody got their turn on top.
Herman Cain.
And Romney never went down below about 23, 24, 25%.
So he had that rock solid support.
He had that rock solid support. And then he ended up winning, which, you know, we like to think that the people who are voting in Republican primaries are the hard right wingers, the Tea Partiers. And that may be, but that doesn't explain then how Mitt Romney became the nominee when he, you know, he was pro-choice when he was governor of Massachusetts, and he passed Romneycare, and he was okay with gay marriage and all of these things.
That was convenient in Massachusetts.
For him to have
those positions.
That's a very good point as well, because that's, you know, he was so wishy-washy. But he never held on to those strong right-wing principles. And granted, he lost the general election, but when we're simply talking...
Well, he lost it, but Eric, one sec, just a pause, because it's too delicious not to mention in the context of this conversation. What was the percentage in Massachusetts in that election? Former governor of the state of Massachusetts got, what, 35, 37%?
It was something like that.
Imagine the turnaround in terms of the perception of the people of Massachusetts about Mitt Romney, who at one time they thought was good enough to be governor, couldn't even get 40% against Barack Obama in Massachusetts for president.
He didn't even run for a second term because his approval was through the floor.
He had gone down, yeah, and to the point where he was a laughingstock in his own home state that he had been governor of and couldn't even hit the 40% mark, I don't think.
Do you have any recollection of how he did against Ted Kennedy when he ran for Senate?
Yes, I do. He really stunned. That was what his breakthrough into the forefront of Massachusetts politics, because Ted Kennedy had always won his elections by overwhelming margins. And I don't think anyone ever challenged him in a primary once he was in. And then in general elections, he would win by overwhelming margins. Even it wasn't as overwhelming after the Chappaquiddick thing because of the obvious reasons he did. There was a little softening of his support there, but even then he stayed pretty strong. And what happened was Romney ran a very aggressive campaign, and he only got, and I can't remember now, Eric, between 43 and 47, and there's a big difference. 47 would have been a lot closer. I think it was 57-43, though. And the fact that Ted Kennedy only got 57% of the vote, people said, wow, he can't beat Ted Kennedy. But he's a heavyweight. If he can even go toe-to-toe and have a respectable showing. And let's say I'm wrong and it was 53-47. It wasn't a nip and tuck. It wasn't there were no recounts. It wasn't anything like that. Kennedy won clearly, but not overwhelmingly. And so that put Romney on the map in Massachusetts. In the year that he ran for governor, he had a relatively weak opponent. And so he was able to win as a Republican in Massachusetts, which does happen from time to time, but not very often, being a native of the state. I know it fairly well.
Interesting. And it is actually 20 minutes after the hour. You're listening to Civil Discourse. Stay with us. We are going to take a short break, and we will be right back.
Who would have guessed that you could eat chocolate to lose weight and regain health? A new product developed by respected medical professionals is available locally and can help your family achieve the health you've always wanted. Free samples are available. Call 608-563-0111 or check out www.chocolatesforlife.com. Chocolates, the number 4, for life.com or call 608-563-0111.
And we are back. Welcome back to Civil Discourse. We are live every Saturday at 11 a.m. Central Standard Time. Just go to blogtalkradio.com, do a search for Janesville Community Radio, and click on the link for Civil Discourse. My name is Eric Brandt. With me is Peter Baer. And if you would like to call in with your comments, 323-580-5769. And we've been talking about the Senate, controlled by Democrats, has passed an extension of unemployment insurance. And it's now sitting at the House. For anyone who's tuning in who was expecting to hear Amar Kalika, I have to apologize. He has not called in as of yet. And we do have Mike McCabe calling in about 8 minutes, and he's going to be talking about what is going on with Mike Ellis. So we're, you know, this conversation is going to kind of lead into what was going on with Mike Ellis and, with Tom
Petri.
I can never say his last name right. Because we're talking about how the Republicans are really just kind of purging any sort of moderation, out of their party. Dale Schultz is gone. He's not coming back, and he's even gone as far as to say that he's not willing to defend these guys anymore based on the votes that they're making. Petri was going to be running. He had, someone from his office had come out and said that he was going to run for one more term, and then Glenn Grothman decided that he was going to run against him in the primary, and now Petri came out and said that he won't be running. And now Mike Ellis was recently caught talking about starting an illegal super PAC, and now he won't be running. And Peter, we were discussing before the show, and I have not had a chance to look at a map, but if I'm not mistaken, Ellis's district is within Petri's.
I think that's true. Well, Petri's from Fond du Lac. Ellis is from Neenah, which isn't that far away. I believe that district is within Petri's congressional district, or at least most of it. Remember, for state senate districts have each 3 assembly districts in them. But the way that the congressional districts are carved up, particularly after the last grotesque reapportionment, but even before that, the congressional districts are kind of funny. For example, when I served in the state senate, I had 3 different members of Congress that represented portions of my state senate district. Sounds kind of strange, but we had Bob Kassenmeier, who held the seat that was later held by Tammy Baldwin and is currently held by Mark Pocan. I had part of that district. I had part of the district that Sensenbrenner has now, and part of the district that Paul Ryan has now, opponent of the person we had hoped to have on our program today.
Do you remember that clip of Letterman with McCain that Rachel Maddow had on?
Yeah, apparently McCain canceled all, of course, we don't quite have the stature of Letterman here, to put it mildly, but
not yet.
But at the not yet, I love your I love your spirit, sir. And that is the case. However, neither is Mr. Kalika at John McCain's level, but there was a sort of situation where McCain was going to appear on Letterman and then canceled at the last minute. And Letterman really went to town on him, found out that his cancellation was sort of discretionary and didn't have to really happen, and so on and so on. I forget how many times and how many ways Letterman made fun of him, but McCain, who's a pretty feisty guy, as we all know, finally did actually decide to come on Letterman. And Letterman said to him something like, "Well, so what do you have to say?" And McCain, with a big grin, which probably was forced, but nonetheless said, I messed up.
And, you know, I remember when that happened, and I never understood, other than showmanship, why he, quote, suspended his campaign. He was a senator. I mean, yeah, he could go back and he could vote, but that's about it.
It was a very certainly a misguided move, not only in retrospect, but I thought so at the time. Unbelievable, shocking. As Letterman made fun of, what do you even have to suspend your campaign for? I think that McCain was probably trying to convey to the voting public a grave sense of urgency about the economic situation in the country at the moment. But he picked a very weird way of doing it, in a way that ended up backfiring on him, for the most part. And it would have backfired on him even if Letterman hadn't torn him to pieces. But that leads to another thing, since we have just a couple of minutes, Eric, before our next guest arrives telephonically. This past week, and it's not a political event as in the ordinary sense, but Stephen Colbert was picked to replace Letterman. Well, most everyone who's listening probably knows that already. But that is a very political thing that's happening in our country that has not been, except for Rush Limbaugh coming out, because he sees the writing on the wall with Colbert taking over. Colbert is a dyed-in-the-wool progressive who does parody of right-wing conservatives by pretending to be a right-wing conservative, but he shows how ridiculous they are. And so they hate him. Those who have figured it out, some of them still haven't even figured it out, but Limbaugh, give him credit, at least has figured out that much, and so has now called the selection of Colbert a war on the American heartland. It's getting started. And what Colbert is going to do, I mean, what Letterman did to McCain will look like a Sunday school picnic compared to what Colbert will do to these Tea Party types like Limbaugh.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how Colbert does this, because, you know, right now, it's, I guess what the net of it is that Colbert has a known persona, and that's what got him this gig. But is it the Tonight Show or the Late Show?
Late Night with David Letterman.
Late Night. That show also has a persona.
Right.
And so is it going to go all or nothing in one direction, or is Colbert going to be creative enough to combine these two different things, kind of interweave them and expand the audience that he currently has on Comedy Central?
Obviously, CBS has confidence that he will have the ability to do what you just said. Whether they are betting their money right or not, I don't know, but I would, if I had to bet, I'd bet how they're betting, because Colbert is a smart guy. He said, actually, after this all happened, it won't be the persona that I do on the Comedy Channel, but Comedy Central. But he said, let's see how far away that character is from my real personality. We'll find out.
And he's so talented that I have no doubt that he'll be able to figure this out. They wouldn't have given him this gig if they didn't know that he was going to figure it out.
That character, I just have an abiding feeling that that character will still be alive and well, but just presented in a slightly different way, because he can't do it quite exactly the way he's doing it now on that show.
And I think that I think it's pretty funny that Limbaugh came out the way that he did. And I listened to his full rant, which the clip that I heard was, I don't know, maybe 3 minutes or so of my life that I'll never get back.
Sorry about that. But it was for a cause. You got to hear the rabid, you know, thing that's coming. He's the front line of it. They're going to be going out. They're going to try and make a war with Colbert now. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
But it's to be taken seriously, not seriously in the sense that I don't think Limbaugh will be able to get cause Colbert not to have a show. What they're afraid of, and rightfully so, is that Colbert may cause them to not win elections.
That's exactly right. Is he's got a much broader base now, that because, you know, Comedy Central is, it's good, you know, he's got a great program, but it's Comedy Central, you know, it's still comedy. And It's just got a smaller base. I mean, even Jon Stewart, I think, pointed out that you have to have a cable subscription. You don't now.
Right.
Anybody is going to be able to watch him.
Right.
And that certainly got them a little bit nervous.
There's a history to this. I'm going back to the days of Johnny Carson and subsequently Leno and Letterman. they tend to stay and always have non-political most of the time. But when they get to the point where they start making fun of a politician and they sustain it for several over a period of days, like Chris Christie had this experience recently with George Washington Bridge and getting on those shows, you don't want to get on those shows in that way. Those shows have always had a very serious amount of influence on the pop culture of the United States at the time, such as it is. And have whenever those guys, because they generally tend to stay away from, say, controversial political positions and so forth, they occasionally put their toe in the water on this stuff. And when they put their toe in the water on political stuff and they're making fun, if someone has risen to the level of ridicule, the level of ridicule that they are made fun of by these guys on the late night show, network late night shows. Forget about Comedy Central. That's a tiny fraction of the audience of the networks. And when the networks start making fun of you on late night, watch out.
I agree. And it is actually time for us to segue. And we are now going to be talking about more of what was going on with Mike Ellis. And joining us on the line now is a gentleman that I've been looking for an excuse to bring on our program for quite some time, is the executive director of Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, Mr. Mike McCabe. Mr. McCabe, welcome to our program.
Well, thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
Really appreciate you giving us your time. Mr. McCabe, you were the first person that I saw to really kind of break this story. You had, as soon as this video came out, you were the first one to put up on Facebook what was happening. Can you kind of explain to our listeners what we saw in this video that makes it so important?
Well, it was a hidden camera video, and you know, there are questions certainly surrounding the individual who shot this footage. He is often posed as sort of an imposter, pretending to be someone he's not, or people who work for him do that, and then they use a hidden camera to capture comments. And so, you know, there's certainly part of the story is the tactics of the operation that produced this. But even setting that aside, you know, you can't forgive Senator Ellis for what he said. He said what he said, and it happened to be captured by a hidden camera. And what he was describing was creating an operation that would basically be a shadow campaign, a front group that would do his dirty work for him, and that he would actually raise the money for that front group. And he even said that he had commitments from several large donors up in the Fox Valley, which is the area of the state where he represents. And he claimed that he already had commitments for $50,000 from several wealthy donors, and that he had a person who was going to, you know, make the ads that would attack his opponent, and sort of, as he put it, manufacture the crap, and that he didn't want to attack his opponent, but rather he wanted somebody else to do it, and so he was going to set up his own shadow campaign, his own front group. And all of this, of course, was captured on camera, and it clearly put him in big trouble politically, if not legally.
There was enough specificity, Mike, in my view, in the words that he said, that would suggest that even though he may have been slightly inebriated, and it probably was from my observation of that tape, that video, that there was some truth to what he was saying, because there was so much specificity in it. He also said on the tape that he was 60 years old, which is not true, of course, and he's quite a bit older than that. And so not everything he said was necessarily even something he was going to do. There's a thing called, and I'm not suggesting that he's an alcoholic, by the way, when I say alcoholic grandiosity, but under the influence of alcohol, there tends to be a certain grandiosity. And who knows if he was actually going to do it or not, but it certainly appeared that he was going to. And one sure way, I think, for him to avoid potential prosecution for something he hadn't yet done but had only thought of and spoken of, by retiring now, he probably eliminates the threat of prosecution, which I suspect figured into his calculation.
Well, I think you're right, and I'm not sure that he should be out of legal jeopardy because he did speak very specifically about particular individuals who he said had made commitments to make these large donations, and he named a person who was going to be the operative that would run this front group. Now she quickly ran for the hills. She quickly said that she wanted nothing to do with the Ellis campaign anymore. But you know, the thing is that given what he said, and he named particular individuals. He described the whole operation very specifically. That to me warranted investigation for possible conspiracy to commit campaign finance fraud, because the operation that he was describing is illegal. It's not legal for a state Senate candidate to take any more than $1,000 from an individual donor. And he was describing donors who had committed $50,000.
Sure, absolutely.
It's also not legal for a candidate to take that money for anything other than his own campaign committee. And he was talking about setting up a separate, what he described as a super PAC. Now, you know, a super PAC is actually a creature of federal law, not state law. But I think he was using the term sort of euphemistically. Everybody knows that these super PACs are sort of dark money groups, these shadow groups or front groups that often do the dirty work in campaigns. And so, you know, he was describing this operation, which is plainly illegal. And you know, even if he didn't actually get the donations, and even if the group was not actually formed, you know, there is the question of whether he in fact had conspired to commit campaign finance fraud. And in that case, it would warrant investigation. He, of course, has now retired. He's ended a 44-year career in the state Senate and stepped away. And I do suspect you're right. I think the decision to leave very abruptly has everything to do with this video, everything to do with what he said on that video, and of course, you know, the fact that he's not only in great political jeopardy, but legal jeopardy as well.
Exactly, Mike. And I think the lipstick that he chose to apply to this particular pig was that it just doesn't work to be a moderate Republican anymore. And I'm a creature of the time past when there was some bipartisanship and all that. When the truth of it is really that although Mike was, from my limited experience, the time I served with him, sortly a more approachable person than some other Republicans at just at a sort of a personal level. His voting record isn't much to be distinguished from among most conservative voting people in the legislature, who pretty much vote in lockstep as it happens. I think the thing is that with him retiring, he is less, although I agree with you, strictly speaking, if we had a totally equitable justice system, this man could be held accountable by way of prosecution for conspiracy to commit illegal acts. But I think he also recognizes the political reality that when one gets into such circumstances and one simply leaves public office behind, prosecutors tend to have less appetite to invest resources in going after you.
I agree with that 100%, and I think the Dane County District Attorney has already signaled as much that he doesn't seem inclined to seek to prosecute the case. Yeah. You know, when initially the video broke and it got out there, his initial response was that he said these things, and then the next day he was told that it actually would be illegal, and he went no further with it. You know, my reaction to that is that just wasn't a plausible line to take. You know,
especially for someone running for attorney general of the state.
Well, you know, Senator Ellis is a guy who served in the legislature for 44 years, so he ran for office dozens of times. He certainly was familiar with the way election campaigns work. He's also somebody who authored campaign finance legislation, and he actually authored campaign finance legislation that dealt with this very issue of groups outside of candidate campaigns that operate in the dark, that they're able to keep their donors and their spending secret. So This is the guy who actually wrote legislation addressing the very thing, the very kinds of operations that he was trying to apparently set up here. So it just wasn't plausible, remotely plausible, that he discovered a day after being filmed that, this was, an illegal setup and he went no further.
So it's kind of a Jimmy Swaggart thing? Jimmy Swaggart moment? Maybe for him here.
Yeah, you know, and I think it was such a ridiculous position that he was in. I think that's what led very quickly, you know, a matter of a day or two later, him saying, you know, what I'm just going to retire. And of course he'll try to characterize the 44 years in a way that kind of glosses over this last incident. But I think what's terribly sad here is, you know, whether you like Senator Ellis or dislike him, whatever you make of his 44 years in office, this is such a sign of the times, and it's such an outgrowth of the, you know, the very poisonous environment that has developed at the Capitol, and it's such an outgrowth of the scandalous nature of our election financing system.
Mike, you really,
you know, and here's a guy who seemingly was being caught up in that, at least was you know, talking about it in a bar, and it was so out of character with everything that he had always said he stood for. So it really is, you know, it showed a hypocrisy that I think is pretty revolting. And so he didn't really have a leg to stand on anymore politically.
Mike, you really just read my mind, because the next question I was going to ask is, in this new world of Citizens United and with the McCutcheon decision coming down last week, is this just the new norm? Is Ellis doing anything that countless other politicians are not doing right now? Is he just the one who got caught doing it?
Well, you know, it should be noted that there's an ongoing criminal investigation, a John Doe proceeding, that appears to be focusing on this very issue of coordination between candidates and these outside interest groups that sponsor their own advertising. And clearly, after the first John Doe investigation a few years ago, which produced the convictions of six associates of Governor Walker, you know, clearly the investigators happened upon something that led them to believe that there was this kind of coordination going on. The exact same kind of thing that Senator Ellis got caught on camera describing is under investigation with respect to at least the governor's campaign and perhaps other legislative campaigns. But, you know, I don't think there's any question that given the nature of the way the system works today, which is, you know, a badly broken and very crooked system, I think the pressure on the participants in that system to go right up to the line and maybe tiptoe across it, or maybe just very brazenly erase the line and just walk over to the side of illegality, those pressures are enormous. If one side does it, the other side feels like it has to reciprocate, then the game gets played in this way, and it really takes us down this sort of death spiral. And I think that you're going to see more and more politicians ruined. I think what the Supreme Court has set up really is the emergence of a new system of legal bribery,
right,
that's growing up around us.
Agreed.
You know, Wisconsin became a state in 1848. For the first half century of statehood, it was perfectly legal to bribe public officials. Bribery wasn't outlawed until 1897. When that happened, when that bribery prohibition occurred, that opened the door to all kinds of progressive legislation, workers' compensation, railroad regulation, insurance reform, taxation based on ability to pay, education advances. All kinds of progressive reforms quickly followed because lawmakers were suddenly free to do the public's will. and to do what the people wanted and needed. They were no longer being legally bribed. I have a hard time looking at today's conditions and not coming to the conclusion that basically we've gone full circle and we're right back to the conditions that existed in the late 1800s, where you had people being legally bribed and then feeling the need to constantly cater to those who are doing the bribing.
Mike, we're just about out of time with you here. Is there anything you'd like to tell our listeners about Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, how they can get involved, any events coming up?
Well, you know, we are a nonpartisan watchdog group first and foremost, and we track the money in politics. We manage an online database where people can see who's giving to whom, see donors to state campaigns. We also advocate for reforms. Our goal is to try to create a system where people matter more than money. You can just Google Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and you'll find us. The website is WISDC.org, but if you just search Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, you'll come to us. And we actually have our annual membership meeting coming up on May 2nd. And Lawrence Lessig, a Harvard University professor who wrote the very acclaimed book Republic Lost, is going to be our guest speaker. He's coming to Wisconsin to speak. He's also behind he was the founder of a national group called Root Strikers, and he's part of what's been called the New Hampshire Rebellion. And so we're really fortunate to have Lawrence Lessig coming to Wisconsin. He'll be speaking at the Barrymore Theater on Friday evening, May 2nd. The public's welcome. So if people want to come and see Lessig and learn more about the Democracy Campaign, that event would be a great place to start.
Excellent.
Thank you so much, not only for being on our show, Mike, but for the great work you're doing.
Yeah, and you came on after short notice,
so
we really appreciate it. Everyone get over to WISDC.org and check out Mike's group. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Bye-bye.
All right, enjoy the rest of the day, guys.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks. Bye. And we actually need to go to a quick break. We will be back in just a minute.
Do you have a home-based business? Have you fully considered the implications of giving out your home address on social media? Facebook requires an address for a business page, which will pinpoint anyone viewing your page to your personal address. Consider a more convenient and safe alternative for maintaining your family's privacy. Renting a virtual office at MyOfficeJBL provides you with a safe and secure address for your business. Virtual office packages start as low as $45 per month. Check out www.myoffice-jbl.com or visit us at 321 East Milwaukee Street in downtown Janesville.
And we are back. You are listening to Civil Discourse on Janesville Community Radio. We're here live every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. You can listen to us by going to blogtalkradio.com, do a search for Janesville Community Radio, and click on the link for Civil Discourse. My name is Eric Brandt, my co-host here, Peter Baer. And if you'd like to call in, 323-580-5769. We just got off the phone with Mike McCabe of Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and we were discussing the scandal that is unfortunately ending a 44-year-long career in Wisconsin politics. Mike Ellis will not be seeking re-election after he was exposed on a hidden camera plotting to start his own super PAC, which is not legal, even though he claims to have not known that, which I find...
I think Mike McCabe gave the lie to that pretty effectively, pointing out that Ellis has been not just a co-sponsor, but a sponsor and an aggressive one of reforms specifically aimed at the kind of unlawful activity that he was proposing to do at the Inn on the Park, under the influence of a few drinks, but it's unlikely that just a few drinks would have produced all that specificity. It sounds like there was a real plan in motion, and if that is true, of course, it would have been entirely criminal conduct. And once that was revealed, as we just discussed with Mike McCabe, it was really untenable. His position was untenable. The fear of prosecution, even for conspiracy to do. He could still theoretically be prosecuted for that, but the appetite of prosecutors is usually wet when someone in that position simply resigns, especially it being, I don't know his exact age, but a little over 70 probably.
I think he's 73.
73, okay. At that age, he's retiring. He's not going to do the thing he might have been conspiring to do. So the appetite to spend prosecutorial resources on a 73-year-old man who's going home just isn't probably there.
You know, one of the things that I took away from this, and we didn't even get into the facts that he went after Scott Walker, and we've got some time left in the show here so we can talk about that. But one of the things that I took away from this is that he was naming people from the Mills family as donors. And I read that they are the ones who own Fleet Farm down here in southern Wisconsin. It's called Farm and Fleet. And I don't know, I believe it's owned by the same family, and then the brothers split and one took the north, one took the south, Farm and Fleet versus Fleet Farm. What this says to me, and I think it's really important for people to understand the world that we're living in right now, and Russ Feingold has done a great job of articulating this at Fighting Bob Fest, and then I also saw him at Netroots, and he gave the same speech, and he said that we now have to choose between liberal and conservative, Democrat and Republican toothpaste. With every decision that we make when we're at a store, that every dollar that you spend by those companies can then be used for political contributions. And I try to vote with my dollars. And as a out and out liberal, I'm running out of places to spend my money here. And fortunately, living in the Madison area, there's enough local businesses. It's a blue enough district where I can pretty confidently go and spend my money at local places. But places like Janesville, it's mostly chains and it's large businesses. Places like Home Depot and Menards, who are Republican supporters, Walmart, which is a huge Republican supporter, all of these places, even Target, you're voting with your dollars.
It's true.
And it's just
keep McDonald's.
Sickening.
McDonald's was the family that founded McDonald's tends to give on the progressive side, but that's pretty rare for a large corporation.
It absolutely is, and I think that is something that people need to be paying attention to. And I know that there are people paying attention to it after Citizens United, especially, and now with the McCutcheon decision, you've got, you know, Move to Amend. And there's another one too, which they've got kind of a cool name and I totally forgot what it was. They're not as well known, but look at Move to Amend. They went out and they got 13 communities to pass a referendum in early April, on April 1st, in the April election, sorry, they got 13 communities to pass a referendum calling for a constitutional amendment saying that money is not speech and corporations are not people. And a day later, the McCutcheon decision came down. So I think the people are waking up to this. And it, you know, ironically, you see the Democrats who also take the money, but they're also the ones who tend to be on the side of wanting to get the money out of politics. And then you see Rance Priebus come out, and he said that he still thinks that there's too many restrictions on money, and we need to lift all the caps.
I'll bet he does, because that's what they need. They don't have the majority. It's clear that if everyone who is eligible to vote voted, they would be almost a fringe party. Might be a slight exaggeration, but they would certainly not be in power at any level. So they are pretty much relegated. And the 2012 election showed that, even though the turnout could have been higher. If it was higher, that would have only increased Obama's margin, because all the Romney people came out and not all the Obama people. And Obama still won by a comfortable margin. So the demographics are pretty clear. There's no way they can win on the merits in most places, certainly not enough to have majorities in either House of Congress or the state legislatures or governorships or any of that if everyone voted. So the theme has to be to suppress votes on the one side through voter ID laws and then to buy votes essentially on the other side through unrestricted campaign dollars. And so you have the voter suppression to keep some potential Democratic voters away from the polls. Then you have the big money to swamp through the media swing voters who watch ads on television. And if you can buy 10 times, or let's say like Walker and Barrett, 8 times more ads than the other guy or woman, you're going to win. And so that's their formula. Voter suppression on the one hand, huge campaign dollars with no limits on the other.
Yeah, and I just read an article this morning. I was digging through my notes, and I don't think that I put everything down, but it was talking about how all of these Coke-funded groups are flooding all this money against people like Mark Bagich and a lot of other Democrats who were elected in 2008 or re-elected in 2008, which was a Democratic wave year. Some of them maybe technically shouldn't have won, not that they didn't have the votes, but because it's a traditionally red state and the, you know, the Republican super PACs know this, so they're flooding it with all this money. And a lot of these guys are burning through cash pretty quick trying to keep up on the Republican side. But on the other hand, they're also noticing that a lot of the Democratic donors, the, you know, the big money on the Democratic side, they're starting to step up and start to throw more money at it. And I've really got mixed feelings on this because on one hand, I want the Democrats to hold the Senate. I mean, I'm not, you know, letting any cat out of the bag there. I want the Democrats to hold the Senate. I want them to take the House. And I know that they need money to do that. On the other hand, it's a double-edged sword. On the other hand, that money generally is going to come with strings attached, and these people are going to be expected to give more more attention to these people who have given them the money, and there's things that these donors are going to want in return. And I think there's the Mark Pocans and whatnot. Granted, he's in a very blue district, probably doesn't need to raise that much money, but there's people, you know, maybe Sherrod Brown, who are going to, not this year, but in 2012, certainly had to take money, maybe when he didn't necessarily want to. And I think that he still has the integrity to know how to play that game.
You picked a great one, Eric, when you mentioned Sherrod Brown, because I certainly agree with you. He has the integrity to be able to do that. What they used to say and probably still say in legislatures, if you can't drink their wine and eat their beef and whatever the night before and vote against them in the morning, you're in the wrong business. And guys like Sherrod Brown understand that. They know that. It takes money to run campaigns. When I was first elected, it was on the open meetings issue, and one of the big issues was closed caucuses, where all the business got done. So then there was the issue in the Capital Times, which was a daily paper back then, and also covered by the State Journal. Is Peter Baer going to go into a closed caucus in order to vote to open up the caucuses now that he toppled the speaker over that issue, certainly that issue? And the answer was, yes, of course I will. Guess what? That was the last closed caucus there was. I was there. We voted to open it, and it was open. It's been open ever since, and government didn't crumble because of that. It may have been crumbling for other reasons, but not that reason.
And that actually takes us up to the end of the show. I want to thank everyone for listening. And again, apologies from us at Civil Discourse. Amar Kalika had confirmed that he would be calling in. And I know that some of you are listening because we advertised that. We did not get a phone call from Amar, and so I apologize. We do have Rob Zerban on the schedule for next week. Mr. Zerban will be joining us in the first half of the show. I want to thank 350 Madison for the work that they're doing, the Econimowoc Dems, and the Rock County Progressives and the Rock County Dems. And if you liked our show, please tell your friends about it. Be sure to listen every single Saturday. We are live at 11 a.m. on blogtalkradio.com. Do a search for Janesville Community Radio and click on this link for Civil Discourse. You can follow us on Facebook, look up Civil Discourse. Check us out on Twitter, @CDiscourse. And be sure to subscribe on iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and leave comments. It helps get us up in the ratings. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, give us an email at civildiscourse2011@hotmail.com. That's going to do it for this week. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Eric.
90 seconds.